Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Chico author Nick Hansen writes under the name N.J. Hansen. He's been writing seriously since high school. He released 9 books in 10 years, his first at the age of 24. His love of science fiction and fantasy inspired that first book, The Last Stand of the Dragon. He attends conventions and book fairs up and down the West Coast, signing autographs and meeting fans. His latest book is The Broken Chain. It's a second in a series he calls The Ravenwood Hauntings. Nick Hansen, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I mentioned that you sign autographs and you meet fans. Who are the people who are fans of your kind of writing?
The people, well, I think the most people that are fans are probably the people who enjoy reading. But it is also, I attend a lot of comic book conventions and book fairs. And since I attend a lot of the same shows year after year, I do tend to run into a lot of the similar people time after time. And then they'll keep coming back to me and saying, oh, I got your book last year. Do you have another one out yet? So that tends to happen. It's always nice when that starts to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mentioned that you're, I noticed that you are a member of the North State Writers, and you must have joined pretty young.
I was, for the longest time, the youngest person in the club. I joined it about when it started, around 2014, 2015. So I was one of the initial members back when they began.
So you were still a teenager when you were joining this writers group?
Oh, no. I was somewhere in my early mid-20s when I joined them. So it's still been a minute, though.
So you've been a member quite a while, then, of this writers group.
For the duration of the club, the whole time they've been around, yes.
Well, the cover of your book is different because I've seen your other books, this fantasy that Steve Fershad, a well-known illustrator, typically illustrates the covers of your book. But this one was different. Why was it different?
So this one, I was following the similar trend that I had done with the first book in this series. I had bought a cover off of a website called Self-Pub Book Covers, now just called bookcovers.com. where they have pre-made book covers for sale. So after I bought the first one for the first book, I knew I needed to go back and get a similar design, similar setup to the second one to keep the series consistent from book to book so that they'd all be instantly recognizable together.
Well, why don't you describe the cover for listeners?
So the cover of this one, it has the main character of this book, the young girl, Tamika Little, a younger black girl. And she takes up about the first top half of the book.
Then I have the cover.
Half the cover, yes. And then I have the title in the center, The Broken Chain, Ravenwood Hauntings Book 2. And below, I have a darkly lit street under the moon, lined with trees, and 2 ghostly figures stalking the middle of it.
So the bottom half is pretty scary looking.
Yes, it is.
And the top, that expression on her face is haunting in itself. To look at her face, lovely young woman, very young, looks like she's a teenager maybe.
In the book, she is described as 11, so a little bit younger than teenager. Of course, when it's a pre-made cover, there's only so much that I can do.
Now, part of the title, The Broken Chain, The Ravenwood Hauntings, Book 2. What is Ravenwood?
So Ravenwood is the chosen last name of one of our other main characters. Her name is Serena Ravenwood. So when I was trying to decide on a title for the series, since she is the most recognizable character, I decided to go with her last name. She will appear in all of the books. So it kind of centers around her to a degree. And she has the most distinctive name of anybody in the story.
Well, the title of that first book in this series, An Empty Swing, and you introduce a couple of characters in The Empty Swing, and people must have said, but Nick, what happened to those characters?
That is, in fact, exactly what started happening. So the characters that were introduced in the first book, of course, Lewis and Serena, who are our two main characters in that book. But this book, while they're still present, the characters that focus around here are Tamika and another character named Butch, who were introduced in book one, but I was told that their story needed to continue, needed to advance to get some closure for them, so they became the focus of the second book.
So what kind of themes did you explore in this book?
When I started writing it, I was just trying to continue the story, basically figure out where they're going, but a lot of the themes that still came up were dealing with past trauma. That seems to be a common thread in every book in this series, as well as themes of characters perhaps slipping through the cracks in different social systems, social safety nets that aren't catching people, and a theme of perhaps self-induced justice, where justice doesn't help you, you have to go get it for yourself, and how that can and cannot help you.
My guest is Nick Hanson, and he writes under the name N.J. Hanson. And I'm going to be asking him about a second book in a series, The Ravenwood Hauntings. The title of this book is The Broken Chain. And I like your beginning, Nick. Would you read us chapter one?
Sure.
The first couple of pages.
Of course. So one, she found herself surrounded in darkness, a thick, viscous substance that clung to her body and filled her lungs. She couldn't breathe, couldn't see, and couldn't move. Her arms and legs were stuck, held down by the blackness. "I found you again," a voice came from the darkness. A cold chill ran up her spine. She recognized it as the voice of the monster, the thing that hurt her. "Did you think you'd be free of me just because I'm dead?" Her heart began to race and her skin felt cold and prickly. Goose flesh grew up her arms. The voice came again. "Death can't stop the real monsters." A sudden burst of fear engulfed her. She tugged on her arms, trying to fight the black energy. Her voice was caught in her throat. "I do so love when they struggle." The monster's vile words echoed in the dark. A pair of shimmering red eyes opened, and she saw its face. Big and inhuman, with a mouth full of dozens of sharp, twisted teeth. Tendrils of black energy surrounded her and snaked around her arms and legs. They were cold, pulsating like stiff muscles. She fought against their pull, but no matter how she struggled, she could not escape. "You know the part I like best," the horrible voice said. The face floated right in front of hers, its red eyes burning with glee. "I like it best when they stop." A long, slimy tongue slithered out of its fang-infested mouth and slid across her face, leaving a trail of saliva in its wake. She grimaced, her eyes clamped closed, and tried to turn away, but the tendrils wrapped around her face and forced her to face the monster. She pressed her lips together as tight as she could, but it wasn't enough. The rancid, disgusting pink tongue licked around her mouth, then forced itself inside. Tamika's eyes snapped open. She lurched up, the blankets falling into her lap. It was dark all around, but not the thick black goo like her nightmare. The dim glow from the nightlight fell in from the hallway through the open crack of her bedroom door. She was in her own house, in her own room, in her own bed. Just a dream. All just a dream. Except it wasn't. Not really. Her brain was still trapped in the memory of that monster, the man that took her.
This is Chico author N.J. Hanson, Nick Hanson, and he was reading from his latest book, The Broken Chain. And boy, your voice is so creepy.
Thank you. I try.
And that whole section just it gives me the creeps, I got to say.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think that's what you're trying to do to
us. Oh, absolutely.
Well, you introduce characters. You've mentioned some of your characters, and you have good guys and bad guys in your book, obviously. So when you introduce this, it's a thing And well, I don't want to give away too much, but we expect human beings, if you're going to have a murderer, you've got a human being a murderer. But I would like for you to read another section of your book, Nick. And this is where we learn, this is on page 57 in your book, we learn about a creepy murderer.
Do. All right, so the pendant's fluorescent green, white, and blue opal stone glistened in the moonlight that fell through the window.
Just a second, excuse me for interrupting, but
oh, sure.
That the pendant, fluorescent green, and it's glistening in the moonlight that fell through the window. The pendant.
The pendant.
Okay, anyway, go ahead.
The chain started to move. At first, it was just a small twitch, a few links of the chain. Then it began to crawl. The necklace crept along the floor, slithering like a snake, under the door and down the hall. The TV was still on in the back room, where Howard Rogers rested in his chair. The room was filled with flashing blue lights and random disjointed sounds. The necklace paused and seemed to consider the room, then continued to the bedroom, where Elaine slept. The woman lay on her stomach, her face pressed against the pillow, her hand hung over the side. The necklace slithered over to her dangling hand. One end of the chain lifted from the floor and reached around to grab her listless finger. The chain wrapped itself around her fingertip, pulled itself up, snaked around her hand and wrist so it could climb up her arm. It crossed her shoulder and finally settled around her neck. There was a sharp intake of breath as Elaine's eyes snapped open. She pushed herself up from the bed, moving in a slow, deliberate manner. The opal pendant shimmered with a light green hue against her breastbone. She strode out of the room, seeming to float more than walk, and made her way across the house back to Howard's TV room. Howard heard a movement and turned to see his wife standing in the doorway. Her face was blank, showing no emotion, with empty, unblinking eyes. She wore a flowing nightgown that almost reached her ankles, and her skin appeared stark white in the light of the television.
"What are you doing up?"
His words were slurred and his eyes felt heavy.
"You should be in bed."
Elaine did not respond. She stared, her eyes still refusing to blink or twitch, and she didn't even appear to be breathing.
"Well, since you're up, get me another drink."
Howard crushed the empty can in his hand and tossed it at his wife. It bounced off her head and clattered to the floor. Still, she did not move. Elaine raised one arm and extended her thin, skeletal index finger at her husband. Howard watched her with confusion and growing anger. His hand slammed against the armrest of his recliner, and he rose to his feet.
"You got some problems," he grumbled. "I think it's been too long since your last lesson. Do I need to get my..."
There was a snap as the necklace unhooked and flew across the room to latch around Howard's throat. He gagged. His veins bulged. He reached for the metal chain as it tightened, digging into his skin and cutting off his airway. Each time he thought he got a good grip on it, the links would slip from his thick fingers and constrict tighter. Howard clasped his hands around his neck as if that would somehow release him from the necklace's hold. As his vision blurred, his wife's emotionless gaze shifted into a deranged, twisted perversion of glee. His legs gave out from under him. He fell back into his recliner. He continued to struggle and thrash until everything fell to darkness. He slumped in his chair, arms fell to his side, head resting against his chest. The necklace remained wrapped around his throat for several minutes, long after he was dead. Only then did it unhook from Howard's throat and slither back to Elaine, where it reconnected around her neck. She lowered her arm and turned to leave the room. Once she was back in bed, Elaine's eyes closed again, and she returned to her peaceful sleep. The necklace unhooked itself and slid along the floor, across the house, back to Butch's bedroom, where it climbed into the pocket of his jacket and remained the rest of the night.
This is Chico author Nick Hansen, writing under the name N.J. Hansen, and this is the broken chain he is reading from. And oh my goodness, the title now, The Broken Chain, we're kind of getting a clue. Chain? And then when you're reading this, we can't believe what we're hearing. And some of the images, like snakes, are just can give you the shivers, and they slither. Mm-hmm. And so you use that word to describe this necklace, a slithering necklace. Nick, where in the world did you get an idea to have a necklace have this personality?
So it was, as I was trying to come up with the idea for where this book should go, what should be, because the first book was A Haunted Playground, what should be the main supernatural element, the main ghostly element of the second book? And eventually I was kind of settling on a piece of cursed jewelry, like a possessed necklace, something that could control the wearer, in a sense, that would use that person, whoever was wearing the necklace, as a puppet to do its bidding. That's where I eventually settled on for this story.
And so at first it's bothering this character, this woman. And then when this guy comes in, we don't like him from the beginning.
Oh, we're absolutely not meant to.
So we don't like him. And so then you mentioned, you said his wife's emotionless gaze shifted into a deranged, twisted perversion of glee. So here's his wife is gleeful at what she's witnessing. But we as readers think, well, yeah, you're justified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you wanted to create.
Yes, the necklace is, it's going after people that it feels deserve it, in a sense. And as you read the book, when you get to the segment, you'll know that this person definitely would have deserved it. So that's how that came about.
So this necklace, in a way, is evil, but do you think so?
As the actions that the necklace takes would be described as evil, but it's one of those situations where you can understand why it's doing what it does. But understanding is not justification, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. My guest is writer N.J. Hansen, and his book is The Broken Chain. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author N.J. Hansen, and he has written book two in The Ravenwood Hauntings. The title of this book is The Broken Chain. You have such interesting scenes in your book, and there's another time when the necklace gets its administers justice. And this is when this necklace murders again.
Okay.
Would you read that section,
sure,
Nick?
They were laughing and cheering with one another, obviously well into a Friday night of partying. A taxi pulled up to the curb and the four drinking friends piled into it. As it pulled away, Michelle signaled to follow.
Excuse me for interrupting you just a second.
No,
because
sure.
You mentioned this group is partying, and maybe you should mention who Michelle is.
So Michelle is the mother of Tamika, our main character. Through a series of events, the necklace transfers from one person to another, and it winds up in her possession at this point in the story, and remains there for a good deal the rest of it.
Okay, so they're out partying, and would you continue? We heard the cab.
The cab drove to the part of town that housed most of the college students. It stopped in front of a house, and one of the riders, Tony, stumbled out onto the sidewalk. He waved to his friends, then shut the taxi door. The cab drove away with the rest of his buddies as he climbed the steps of his porch and fumbled with his keys, trying in vain to identify the key to his front door. Michelle waited for the taxi to leave, then pulled her car alongside the sidewalk. She left the engine running as she got out. The young man at his door, fighting drunkenly with his keys, did not notice her until she climbed the steps and her shadow fell over him. He turned to face her, holding a hand over his eyes to block the light from the car's headlights.
"Hello?"
His words were slurred, full of alcohol.
"Who are you?"
Michelle did not respond. The opal at her throat pulsed with sinister green energy. Her eyes shimmered with the same eerie glow.
"You like something? You see something you like?"
the boy asked, filled with a new level of confidence.
"You want to come inside and have some fun? I'll admit I have a thing for older, darker women."
"Anthony McKimmett," Michelle said at last. "Your hands are stained in blood."
Excuse me just a minute, because she says his name, Anthony, and he's the rest of the book, he's called Tony, just FYI. Yes.
"What the?" Tony blinked and slurred. "How do you know my name?"
"I know everything about you," Michelle said. There was an echo in her voice, as though another person spoke in unison with her. Tony rubbed his eyes and looked again. Where at first one person stood, now there seemed to be two. A second woman, younger and more familiar, stood behind the first like a shadow. He couldn't make out her features, but he saw her eyes shimmer with a greenish glow. Michelle continued,
"You are friends with Samantha Winfield and Joseph Manson. Two nights ago, the three of you invited a girl, Patricia Silverton, out to a party."
Tony dropped his keys. He tried to step away, and his back pressed against the door.
"No, that's impossible."
He grasped the doorknob, but it caught as he tried to turn it, still locked.
"While at that party, you beat her, assaulted her. When she tried to resist, you hurt her more. And when she tried to call for help, you killed her."
The distortion in Michelle's voice grew stronger, sounding more and more like the other girl.
"You wrung her throat and smashed her skull against the pavement. The blood of Patricia Silverton has stained your hands."
"Sam said no one would know."
Tony fought for the door, clutching the knob with both hands, pushing and pulling on it, but it would not open. The face of the shadow girl became clearer, her voice more recognizable, and all the while those shining green eyes bore into him.
"Sam said everything would be fine."
"Sam lied."
"Listen, Trish, I never meant to..."
The necklace snapped off Michelle's neck and coiled around Tony's. He coughed and gasped as the chain tightened. He reached for his throat, but the links of the chain were too small for him. His face turned red and eyes bulged. The veins in his neck strained as the chain constricted around his throat. Tony fell to the ground, still struggling against the ever-growing strength of the necklace. He spotted his keys and tried to reach for them, but his arms were too heavy and fingers too weak to hold them. He gasped once more, then fell limp. When it was done, Michelle held out her hand, and the necklace returned to her. As the chain latched around her neck and the opal rested against her breastbone, she returned to her car and drove away. Tony's cooling, stiffening corpse was left on the porch, his cold fingers resting on the house keys.
This is Chico author N.J. Hansen, Nick Hansen, reading from his latest book, The Broken Chain. And it's a second in a series that he is creating, The Ravenwood Hauntings. And this is book two that he is reading from. And my goodness. So you have this murderer that is not a human.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the first murder that this necklace has created.
By that point in the story is actually the third.
The third time this necklace has murdered one of the characters in your book. And so you wanted to create mixed feelings, I think, in the reader about this necklace, didn't you, Nick?
I wanted the reader to understand where it's coming from, why it's doing what it's doing, and why it's specifically targeting certain people. Because it's not killing indiscriminately. It has a list that it wants to go after. So, of course, how it goes about that, and if somebody gets in the way of it completing that list, it'll take out its aggression towards them, too. But it's not just killing people indiscriminately.
My goodness. Well, there's one more section I'd like for you to read in your book, Nick. And this is a character named Serena. And what happens to Serena?
So Serena is one of the main characters in the series overall. The first book was primarily about her dealing with the loss of her older sister and eventually getting closure for what happened there. By the second book, her dad is now dating another woman. She has a younger stepsister, Tamika, who is the main character of this book. So they're bonding, they're growing closer together. But as the story goes on, occasionally she'll still have fights and spats with her father, which is what brings us to some of the scenes that happen later on in the story.
Okay, would you read that section about Serena?
Okay. Serena pressed the disconnect button and tossed her phone in her lap with a huff. She placed a hand against her forehead, closed her eyes, and leaned against the steering wheel. She sat that way for a few long moments, annoyed and frustrated with her father. The car had fallen into an awkward silence. She looked around, noticing the surprised looks of both Louis, Butch, and the hurtful look of Tamika. "What's wrong?" "You don't like my mom?" Tamika asked, holding back a sob. "What? No, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean it that way. You said my mom wasn't your real mom. Does that mean I'm not your real sister?" Serena shifted in her seat to face Tamika. "Mika, listen," she said, and took the younger girl's hand in hers. "Would I be doing everything I'm doing if I didn't think of you as my sister already?" Tamika rubbed one eye. "I guess not." "Sometimes, when people get angry, they say things they don't mean, or things that are hurtful. But that doesn't mean it's true," Serena said. "Ha!" Butch's laughter came from the back seat. "That's a load of bull. Most of the time, people are more honest when they're mad. That's when they're not trying to be polite, and they just scream what they really think."
This is Chico author Nick Hansen, N.J. Hansen, reading from The Broken Chain. And these characters, you've told us about some of the characters, but a name that came up in this reading was the name Butch. And I don't want to give away the surprises, so we're not going to go into the ending of this.
No spoilers now.
No spoiler. However, I wanted to remind listeners how the opening sentence of your book, and this is where you have this nightmare. We don't know it's a nightmare at first, but Tamika is having a nightmare. And the first sentence in your book is, she found herself surrounded in darkness. And again, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I did want to go to the very last sentence in your book, the last phrase, shutting the light off as he went, leaving it surrounded in darkness. So you begin telling us this story with the character surrounded in darkness. And it ends shrouded in darkness. So when we read that, we thought, oh, my goodness. Well, now what happens, Nick? So you must have a plan for a third book.
I do. I'm currently working on the third book in the series, which is titled The Abandoned Attic. It'll take place about a year later. Each one of these books takes place about a year later from the previous one, dealing with another supernatural occurrence, another ghost, and usually another vengeful spirit, which is trying to right some wrong that occurred to them in the past.
Now, you mentioned ghosts, and some people, oh, there's no such thing as ghosts. And other people, oh, yeah, there is such a thing as ghosts. So we'll leave listeners with that thought, because you just mentioned the word ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness, Nick. We will look forward to your next book, which is The Abandoned Attic. Again, my guest has been N.J. Hansen, Nick Hansen. We've been talking about his book, The Broken Chain, which is a second in the Ravenwood Hauntings. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
After a break, I'll be talking to another Chico author, David Ivey, His book is Beyond the Walls of Darkness. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest was in the first class to spend all its high school years at Pleasant Valley. Then he began his college studies at Chico State. C. David Ivey has degrees in mechanical, environmental, and civil engineering from Chico State and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He has professional experience in aircraft carrier defense systems and high-end shopping malls. David Ivey married his high school sweetheart when he got home from a mission in South Africa for the Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints. A year after his first wife died, he remarried and is now a grandfather of 14. He began writing in his spare time and has now published Future History Sci-Fi Stories under the title Beyond the Walls of Darkness. David Ivey, welcome.
Well, thank you.
My goodness, you moved here because your dad, you moved the family here to work on the Titan missile bases?
I mean,
that in itself must be a story.
Well, he was down there when it blew up. It did blow up, and he got out. He said he saw pieces of concrete the size of a garage door flying over his head.
Oh, my.
I was in grammar school and remember hearing the windows rattle.
Oh, my.
And wondering how my dad was doing.
Well, you have such a variety of experience. So why did you you start writing science fiction? And but it's not easy to say what this book is about. So can you tell the listeners what your book is about?
Well, I'm going to answer your first question first. I overheard some of my kids talking, and all them and all of their friends had a very negative view of the future, and I just didn't happen to agree with that. So I started writing science fiction because it's a way of presenting the future, the ideas that I have that are positive. I wanted to share them not only with my children but with my grandchildren and others that I heard. You can see all of the movies, everything in the world today is dystopian, and I don't agree with that.
You did say that one of your sons and his Pleasant Valley, like his dad,
yes.
Pleasant Valley bandmates came over to your house, and they were discussing the future. And when you heard these dismal opinions about global warming and probable nuclear war.
Yep, that's what they were talking about.
And you say, gosh, I didn't see that such a dreary perspective as they did.
Well, they see the negative things, but they never saw any positive after that. They thought that forever and ever it's going to be negative. I don't think so.
Well, because you, I mentioned you have published sci-fi stories, Future History. Now, those two words don't seem to go together, Dave. So how can you write Future History?
Well, it's a very common form of science fiction. Heinlein had an entire series of stories of, well, if we go to the moon, then this can happen. And once we go to the moon, well, then we could do this. And then, well, okay, then what about that? Okay, so in this case, picture, for example, when my grandfather was six, in my grandfather's age, year, generation, if you lived to be 65 or 70, you were doing pretty good. My mom lived to be in her 90s. I expect to live into my hundreds. I expect my kids to live to be 110, 120. There's plenty of science fiction stories out there about the idea that the longer you live, the longer you live. The idea is that eventually we'll get to the point where you'll live forever.
Well, now you're talking about science fiction, and I know you happen to know my first guest, Nick Hansen.
Yes.
And this young man writes fantasy, as I understand it. So what is it? Is there a difference in science fiction and fantasy? Do you have these discussions with Nick?
Yes, of course. We're in the same writers' club, North State Writers, here in town. Nick and I also belong to the same critique group, so we've helped critique each other's work. It's one of the advantages and blessings of being part of the local writers' club. When you go to write fiction, especially science fiction, you have to decide on your universe. You know, do laser swords or magic wands work? And personally, I decided to write about this universe, believe it or not. But with a caveat, a little bit different twist. Picture a big lump of clay. Put it together, pat it into something about the size and shape of a coffee can. Okay, about as tall as it is wide. Take a good sharp knife, put it right in the middle on the top. Angle a little bit, cut off the top corner. Right corner, top left corner, turn it over, cut off the two corners. Religion looks down from on high and sees a circle. Oh, it must be a sphere. Science looks at it straight on and sees a square. It must be a cube. And science fiction people look at it from left field and say, oh, man, you're both crazy. It's a star. Of course, it's a star. Now, look at the picture at the back of the book.
Yes. And I might tell the listeners that Dave is pointing to the back cover of his book, and it's an interesting illustration of...
Well, exactly what I was just talking about. If you look down from the top, it's a circle. From the side, it's a square. From the front, it's a square. And from the side, it's a star. Meaning that all of those perspectives are looking at the same reality, and they just are looking at it from a different point of view. It's the same thing. They just use different words to describe it. So in my writing, I incorporate science, scriptures, and science fiction. I bring all of those together to look at a future where, in this text, we live forever. Okay, now what? What's that like? How do you govern a people that live forever? What's it like to be a part of that? Those are the things that I investigate.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is David Ivey, first initial C. C. David Ivey, and we're looking at Volume 1, Era 3 of Beyond the Walls of Darkness. And you say this takes place in the future, but how do you have it set up, these volumes and these eras?
Well, as I said, I started writing positive stories about the future. So I've organized them into three books: the next 100 years, the next 1,000 years, and the next 10,000 years.
Now that's mind-boggling. You got to know. I mean, trying to imagine the next 100 years might be possible, but the next 1,000 years, or the next
10,000 years. Well, that's when we live forever. I decided to start with that book.
So let me remind the listeners that you're starting with out of chronological
That's
order.
That's why it's called Era 3. This is the third era, but it's the first volume. I decided, hey, if Star Wars can do it out of order, I could too.
Yeah.
I decided if I actually started with the next 100 years, there are going to be some tough times in the next 100 years.
So you're going to write prequels, in other words.
Exactly.
Okay, so this Beyond the Walls of Darkness is Volume 1, Era 3.
Yes.
Okay. My goodness. So you say you published it first because you didn't want to be labeled a dystopian author?
Yes. I as I said, I do not have a negative view of the future. Yes, there'll be a few negative things have to happen, but the overall future is very positive, and I wanted to have that come out first.
And you wanted this younger generation to be optimistic about their future.
That's right.
My goodness. Well, I know listeners must be wondering, well, what does he write about in this book? So how do you explain how you set up this book that you wrote?
Well, first of all, I decided to not write a novel because, frankly, I'm writing to youth, not older people, like all my friends. And I'm hearing from many educators that young people today, frankly, have shorter attention spans. So I wrote shorter stories.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Yes. But it's a sequence of shorter stories. You know, the same main character goes on one world, okay. This world, it's a preservation world where they have a new species that's just coming into intelligence, and so they have to preserve that species and keep humans kind of away from them a little bit. They try. But then that same individual then moves to another world, a casino-type world, and gets to experience what that's like. And then he moves to a paradise-type world. So, the same individual carries through, but you get to see different aspects of this kind of society.
Well, your very first words, you have an introduction, and you say, the worlds of 2 trillion suns over a span of 14 billion years have produced answers to important technological questions like, how can you travel and communicate faster than light? And some that are even more fundamental, such as, how can you live forever in peace?
Not like Star Wars, in other words.
Star Wars. And you say that this book that you've just written, Beyond, is a collection of related short stories illustrating different aspects of such an ancient, advanced, intergalactic civilization. And you mentioned that Nick had a suggestion for you that when you were talking about this book with Nick, you decided you're going to write a foreword in your next edition. But you tell us in your introduction what this book really is consists of, these short stories. And you say you like stories that raise the question, what if?
One of my favorite authors wrote a story back in the age of Sputnik. What if you could put a satellite far enough away from the Earth that it rotated around the Earth in the same speed that the Earth rotated? It would appear to just hang there. In that story, he invented communication satellites.
Oh, gosh. That is so exciting. That gives me chills.
That's the kind of story that I enjoy.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of story that this is. What if? What if we could live forever? Okay, what would that mean?
So somebody picks up your book 100 years from now and say, wow, look what Dave Ivey wrote.
It could be. A lot of people that predict the future, almost all of them, you read it 50 years later and it's, oh boy, did this guy ever blow it? I remember reading article after article. This is, all right, where's my air car?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't that long ago. I looked at issues of Life magazine in 1945, and they were saying that, you better learn how to fly because we're going to not be using cars. We're all, families are going to have
10 years from
airplanes.
Now, no problem.
Yeah.
But only just now. We have now air taxis, from the hotel to the airport.
Well, in your book, I mentioned you have an introduction, but you also give a little sample of a couple of your chapters, and one is called Varmints. And so would you read a little bit from Varmints?
Certainly. It was intended as a background for the individual involved and also for some of the other stories. As the very first person on a newly opened world, Brad had been tasked with learning the ropes and passing on info to the later colonists. While out hunting, he had barely outrun a pack of panther-sized blue rat things. Through the small kitchen window, he could see the pack prowling around outside. They were scratching on the door and making very un-rat-like quavering screams that raised the hair on his arms. Then they saw him watching them and attack the window. They can't get through. Of course not. There's no way. But just because he hated to sit and watch them try, he moved into the living room. And that was a little better. That is, until they somehow heard or smelled him in there. The front window, which had been broken by a storm, was covered over with plywood glued to the brick wall. The animals started ripping at it. Brad was able to shoot a couple of them through the holes that they made, but several places were starting to look like Swiss cheese. It was pretty obvious, given the gun's recharge time, that he wasn't going to be able to keep up, and they were going to overwhelm him soon. He'd hardly made it back into the kitchen before he heard them gnawing on that door. And this wasn't one of those indestructible ready-made affairs. Brad looked around, but there wasn't much else he could do, not quickly. The blender, microwave, oven weren't going to be a lot of help. He did throw open the drawer that had his knives, dropping the drawer on the floor, naturally, and scattering the knives. He put a couple of them on the counter, then got behind it and began firing right through the door. It wasn't doing the door any good, of course, but it made him feel better. Suddenly, the noise level went up 2 or 3 notches. I didn't think it could get louder in here, he thought. Then Brad realized the noise was actually coming from outside and ran to the window. It was lizards, a lot of them, and they were big. When one of them stood up on his hind legs to see better, it was as tall as Brad. Plus, they were fast, really fast. A lizard darted in, nipped at a panther, then darted back out with a mouthful of blue fur before the panther could even think about slashing or biting at it. This was happening constantly, first on one side, then the other. They had the panther pack completely surrounded now, out in the middle of the yard. The panthers were huddled together with their backs to the middle and their formidable claws and teeth to the outside. But the lizards still found an opportunity to zip in and back out so quickly that Brad could hardly follow them. Just then, one of them darted in, and the panther took a swipe at it. Quicker than a striking snake, the lizard bit off the swiping paw. The panther was so startled that it tried to back up right over the top of his fellows. When they turned around to see what was happening, the lizards attacked. It was too fast to follow. By the time the dust, scales, and blue fur settled, the panthers were gone, literally. There was nothing large enough left to identify. Though several of the lizards were in a bad way, none appeared to be dead. Brad decided to stay where he was, even keeping away from the window until he was absolutely sure the lizards were all gone. That was one tough bunch. When he finally ventured out into the house, he found it stripped bare. They left his sofa, but nothing else. Even his bed was gone. "Those dang varmints stole me blind," he shouted to no one in particular.
This is Chico author David Ivey, and he's reading from his book, Beyond the Walls of Darkness. And this is a part of a series, The Walls of Darkness. So we will look forward to the next book in your series. Thank you for coming in today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I would also like to thank my first guest, N.J. Nick Hansen. And his book is The Broken Chain. It's book 2 in his series, The Ravenwood Hauntings. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Salmon Festival. It's early fall, and that means the salmon have returned. They arrive just in time for the annual Salmon Festival, the crown jewel of the quaint little town I was raised in and currently have come back to in an attempt to get my life on track. There's something quite charming about a community coming together over fish. Maybe it's the novelty of it all, or maybe it's just the right quirk that gives a faded town a pulse, but we take what we can get, and the man with the stuffed salmon glued to his visor makes me feel all is well for a brief but necessary moment. The crowd gathers at the viewing windows at the fish hatchery, and I am one of them. We ooh and awe over their tired silver bodies charging against the current, and witness their final hours through a glass fogged with handprints. I ask my husband if they can see us looking at them. He tells me they stopped eating months ago and are preparing to die. If they can see us, they probably don't have much energy to think much about it. I look one right in the eye, and I can't tell if it's side-eyeing me or not. We follow the fish ladder down towards the river and see the water squirming. There are thousands of them, many glowing like molten rubies. How they found their way back to their home waters after years of tasting the sea is the work of the highest order, and I'm convinced that the lack of salt must feel good through their gills. So to the sky they jump, maybe for joy, but most certainly because it's their nature. They came here to spawn and die, and I try not to draw the obvious parallels to my own biological clock and my recent move back to a familiar homeland. I quickly pull myself out of the mental quicksand and instead let my mind wander back to my encounter with the side-eyeing fish. I'm now almost certain she saw me as we locked eyes for a blink. Two wild beings pressing onwards against the odds and towards our fate. My own small memento mori. Who knew a fish could remind me that we too must die? That is to say that living and dying are the same current flowing in opposite directions, yet rippling with promise all the same. And maybe that's the truth of it, that the current keeps singing of life, a kind of hope that swells beneath the flushed red underbelly. Kelly Lieberman.
This is called Whether We Dance or Not. My heart is the shape of a club foot, but it wears a jester's hat. Leaping because it loves the elevation, but landing with an inelegant thump because it reckons any patch of ground is a potential grave. Life is not so sweet that it makes me diabetic, not so sinister that I scan the horizon for assassins. I laugh because I recognize the many punchlines of my cosmic predicament. I weep because God tells jokes with the panache of a terrorist lobbing a grenade. So I dive skyward, asking the air to accept my folly, trusting my limbs to launch me into the next moment. Caring not if I tumble, because failure means my wings are in need of repair, and getting up means I still hunger for grace. This is Robert Chancy.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.